the growing conflict between Iran and Pakistan.
Pakistan undertook a series of highly coordinated and specifically targeted precision military strikes against terrorist hideouts in Sistan-o-Baluchistan province of Iran.
Plus, how good a job do journalists do in reporting news from Africa?
There were more than 215,000 articles last year about Prince Harry's book Spare, but only 11,000 about the deadly violence and displacement in Burkina Faso.
And later, Ukraine and Russia traded drone strikes. We'll get an update from Kyiv and a look at a potential crisis facing the upcoming American presidential election. Today is Thursday, January 18th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The U.S. military has launched another wave of missile strikes against Houthi-controlled sites in Yemen, marking the fourth time in days it has directly targeted them. The strikes were launched from the Red Sea and hit 14 missiles that U.S. Central Command deemed as imminent threats. All this as Pakistan's Air Force has launched retaliatory airstrikes in Iran, allegedly targeting militant positions. The attack early Thursday killed at least 9 people and further raised tensions between the neighboring countries in an already tense part of the world. Mumtaz Zahara Baluch is a spokesperson for Pakistan's foreign ministry.
Pakistan undertook a series of highly coordinated and specifically targeted precision military strikes against terrorist hideouts in Sistan-o-Baluchistan province of Iran. A number of terrorists were killed during the intelligence-based operation codenamed Markbar Sarmachar.
The strikes in Sistan and Baluchistan province follow Iran's attack on Pakistani soil that killed 2 children on Tuesday. The strikes imperil diplomatic relations between the 2 neighbors. However, as Baluch maintains, Islamabad, for their part, is not trying to turn this into a larger conflict.
Iran is a brotherly country, and the people of Pakistan have great respect and affection for the people of Iran. We have always emphasized dialogue and cooperation in confronting common challenges, including the menace of terrorism, and will continue to endeavor to find joint solutions.
The attacks also raised the threat of violence spreading in a Middle East unsettled by Israel's war with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. For more context on this developing story, I'm joined by VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief, Sarah Zaman.
So Iran said that it struck Jaish al-Adl terrorists, which are basically working against Iranian interests. And Pakistan said that it attacked BLA, which is the Balochistan Liberation Army, and BLF, Balochistan Liberation Front targets. Both of these are banned militant outfits in Pakistan. The Pakistani side says that anti-state Baloch militants have hideouts across the border in Iran. Iran has said that it has attacked anti-Iran terrorists inside Pakistan's borders. What's very interesting is that both sides in their statements specified that they had attacked hideouts of their own nationals. So Iran said it had attacked and targeted Iranian nationals. Pakistan said it targeted Pakistani origin terrorists, which is a very interesting and important distinction, because analysts say what they're trying to indicate is that they did not harm each other's interests, that they were going after elements that pose a threat to each country's own interests.
So it wasn't necessarily a conflict between Iran and Pakistan directly.
So this is how at least Pakistan's foreign office has framed it. Today, they tried to repeatedly make this distinction. The Pakistani foreign office spokesperson Mumtaz Zahra Baloch, in her weekly presser, made this distinction that this should not be seen as an attack on Iran. Iran was not being targeted. No Iranian institutions or the military was targeted. These attacks were targeting terrorists that are present in space, which they say practically not governed by Iranian government, and that these were people who directly threat Pakistan's interests, and that Pakistan respects Iranian sovereignty.
So Iran is already involved, at least tangentially with its proxies, in the conflict between Israel and Hamas. Is there a relationship between that conflict, Israel and Hamas, and what happened between Iran and Pakistan?
So that's a very important question, because some analysts here say that what Iran did, it could be an attempt to just flex its muscle, because Iranian leadership is under increasing pressure from Hamas, Hezbollah, and Houthis, who expect Iran to do more in backing them in the Israel-Hamas conflict, while the U.S. is pressuring Tehran to stay out of the conflict. So some analysts see Iran's actions as a way for it to show that it still has the ability to strike wherever it sees Iranian interests under threat, which is why we also saw, they say, the attacks in Iraq and Syria this week. While analysts in Pakistan say they hope that this is not what happened between Pakistan and Iran, is not going to get connected with the conflict in Gaza and is not going to become part of the wider war, they do worry that this could also fan the flames of sectarian violence in Pakistan, because Pakistan is majority Sunni Muslims, and Iran is majority Shia Muslims, and Pakistan has in the 90s seen pretty violent proxy war between various sectarian groups.
Well, historically, what has the relationship between Iran and Pakistan been like? There hasn't been any war between them.
Right. There hasn't been any war between the two sides. They also have deep historic ties, but the ties are complex and they're complicated by a couple of external factors. One of those factors is the tensions that have existed between Riyadh and Tehran, because Iran and Saudi Arabia have had very poor relations, very tense relations, and they have funded proxy wars in parts of the region. And again, that comes from sectarian differences. That also comes from foreign policy differences. And Pakistan has paid the price of that. Pakistan has tried to balance its relations between Tehran and Riyadh, and it has at some points struggled to do that, at other points done it successfully. But this is a pressure point for Pakistan. And the other thing is that there are anti-state militants active along the Iran-Pakistan border, because on the Iranian side, you have the Sistan-Balochistan province, and on the Pakistani side, you have the Balochistan province. And there have been militants and separatist militants very active in this part of the shared border. So despite the fact that both countries do have economic ties, they have diplomatic ties, there have been factors that have put a lot of pressure. And last but not the least, the relationship that both of them have with the U.S. is also a very important factor. Pakistan has traditionally been an ally, whereas Iran has not had diplomatic relations with the U.S. For nearly half a century at this point. So that's also a point that creates a conflict between the two, and that brings tensions between the two.
Sarah Zaman is VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief. I reached her in Islamabad. Sarah, thank you for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you so much, Steve. Really appreciate it.
Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, where the current Middle East crisis has its roots, the UN says Palestinians are dying in hospitals every day, as an estimated 60,000 wounded overwhelm the remaining doctors. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
A health emergency expert says Gaza's remaining hospitals can't deal with the estimated 60,000 injured people, with more arriving each day. Two health professionals who recently left Gaza describe overwhelmed doctors trying to save the lives of thousands of wounded people amid collapsing hospitals that have turned into impromptu refugee camps. The World Health Organization's Sean Casey, who left Gaza recently after 5 weeks of trying to get more staff and supplies to the territory's 16 partially functioning hospitals, has told a news conference that he saw a really horrifying situation in the medical units as the health system collapsed day by day. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. When bad things happen in Africa, are they less likely to be reported than if they happened elsewhere in the world? What about good things that happened there? We'll take a look at journalism from the continent in a few minutes. Now, though, to Kyiv and our correspondent, Anna Chernikova, we get a look at the Ukrainian public reaction to President Volodymyr Zelensky's appearance in Davos and the latest drone strikes.
The Ukrainian public reaction to the World Economic Forum in Davos was neutral, without unnecessary expectations. In his speech, Zelensky demonstrated the general mood of the society and said what the Ukrainian public expected to hear from him. There were no surprises. It demonstrates that Ukraine is aware that it was more of a reminder at the highest level that the war in Ukraine continues and that Ukraine needs more economic, military and humanitarian aid from allies because the ending of hostilities still remains in the distant future. The positive moment for Ukraine was the meeting where the Ukrainian peace formula was discussed, which was attended by representatives of more than 80 countries. This demonstrated that Ukrainian proposals are being listened to. Although Ukrainian society is increasingly aware of the impossibility of fully implementing this formula. According to experts, the points of this formula should become a certain starting point in future negotiations, and Ukraine will most likely have to make concessions. Meanwhile, the war in Ukraine shows no signs of ending. Late on January 17th, Russia attacked the city of Chuhuyev in the Kharkiv region. The head of the Kharkiv local military administration confirmed 2 hits in the city, causing damage to a school and residential building. At least 2 civilians were confirmed killed. 2 more were injured. In the early hours of January 18th, the Russian forces attacked Sumy, Mykolaiv, Kherson, Dnipropetrovsk, Kirovohrad and Khmelnytskyi regions with drones. The Ukrainian Air Force confirmed the destruction of 22 of the 33 drones launched by Russia. The main targets of the attack this time were the south and north regions of Ukraine. Also, on the morning of January 18th, Russian officials in the Belgorod region reported a missile threat in the city. Residents were advised to stay at home or go down to a shelter or another safe place. The alarm lasted for only 20 minutes, after which the local authorities reported that they shot down 10 missiles over the region. Meanwhile, more drones were also intercepted in the Moscow and Leningrad regions of the Russian Federation before dawn on January 18th. The mayor of Moscow, Sergei Sobyanin, reported that Russian air defense forces repelled the drone attack that targeted the capital. According to preliminary data, there were no damages or injuries at the place where the debris fell. This is the first time the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation reported the interception of a drone over the Leningrad region, far to the northwest of Moscow. Ukrainian media, referring to sources in the Ukrainian special services, report that the attack by Ukrainian drones in the early hours of January 18th on an oil depot in the Leningrad region of the Russian Federation is a special operation of Ukrainian intelligence. They add that this is not the first attack on the Leningrad region. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
There is a looming potential crisis facing the upcoming American presidential election. We'll learn about that shortly. For the moment, however, we'll stay with the crisis in Ukraine, where people are looking at various plans for reconstruction after the war, but many others are asking if money and attention would be better spent fighting the war first. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
An excavator clears earth and rubble to make way for a reimagined transport hub in the Ukrainian town of Trostianets. It's one of 6 settlements being rebuilt with state funds in a pilot program. The aim is to develop the skills and experience needed for wide-scale reconstruction after the war. Trostianets is barely 20 miles from the Russian border and was badly damaged in fighting almost 2 years ago. Mayor Yuri Bova says if life isn't breathed back into towns, there's a risk millions of Ukrainians could settle permanently abroad instead of redeveloping their country. And seeing the destruction every day traumatizes people, he says.
Today we're fighting for every person who should return, for every child who needs to return and build their future here. Our boys are fighting for these people, not for an abstract purpose, for them and for the future of this country. But it's impossible to imagine a country without its population, or with an active population that has moved abroad, leave only elderly women. That can't happen. So we have to do it today, and this example is the one that will probably start bringing people back.
But the war shows no signs of abating, so not everyone thinks the drive is a priority. In the nearby town of Okhtyrka, Antonina Dmitrychenko says people are saving every last dime to support the armed forces. Victory first and foremost, she says. Okhtyrka's mayor, Pavlo Kuzmenko, has publicly criticized the way Trostianets is being rebuilt.
I was glad that Trostianets was chosen. but I was convinced it was people's homes that were going to be rebuilt and critical infrastructure. Not the central square and a road built 2 years ago. There is enough to rebuild. The square and its beauty can be restored after the war.
The different views in the neighboring towns reflect a broader debate in Ukraine about wartime spending. A growing grassroots protest movement is demanding that authorities shelve projects such as sprucing up streets and public spaces in favor of funding the military. In a sign of the tension, officials in the Odessa region cancelled more than $9 million of tenders late last year, saying spending on road repairs, the renovation of a stadium and software was unacceptable in wartime.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting. In a new report, CARE International says events in Africa are being underreported in the media as global attention shifts to conflicts in Europe and the Middle East. The charity identifies 10 African nations confronting humanitarian challenges from hunger, violence, and climate change, but getting little news coverage. Mohamed Youssef has the story.
The report released last week took the unusual approach of aggregating online articles in Arabic, English, French, German, and Spanish. It found there were more than 215,000 articles last year about Prince Harry's book Spare, but only 11,000 about the deadly violence and displacement in Burkina Faso. There were more than 273,000 articles about the Barbie film, but only 1,000 about the floods, drought, and hunger in Angola that affected some 7 million people. The report, titled Breaking the Silence, mentions many other African crises that are getting little to no media attention. Stefan Brand works with CARE Germany. He explains why the continent's humanitarian crisis is underreported.
I think that big crises, big conflicts, such as the war in Ukraine or now in the Middle East, are receiving the most coverage by international journalists in every country or most of the countries. And therefore, smaller crises are more in the shadow of these big conflicts. But I also think that media channels are more forced to save money because of the lack of interest by public.
CARE International's research singled out 10 African countries, including Zimbabwe, Uganda, Burundi, Zambia, and Senegal, that are suffering crises such as climate change, conflict, poverty, widespread hunger, and political instability. It said more than 77,000 articles were published last year about these countries, while the iPhone 15 generated more than 273,000 stories. Douglas Okwach is the secretary of the Foreign Press Association Africa, an organization of African journalists working for foreign media. He says media budgets have been shrinking, reducing the number of stories being produced from the continent.
I think post-COVID, countries globally really are constrained in terms of resources, and then therefore many countries, particularly the ones that own this big international media, are looking at where to cut, budgets, and probably the media is one of the places or the easiest places to cut budgets. And when you cut budgets, then that have a direct implication on coverage.
International media's closure of foreign bureaus also is blamed for the underreporting and fatigue that has set in after decades of unending conflicts and humanitarian crisis in some African countries. Some critics have accused foreign media of focusing more on Africa's conflict and suffering than its potential and contribution to the world. Okwach, who is also a journalist, says other sectors and global competition for Africa's resources and support are getting more coverage than the humanitarian crisis.
Cannot just focus on the humanitarian, the fewer, the lesser humanitarian stories, and think that things in Africa are on a downward spiral in terms of focus on Africa. I think if there's less coverage on humanitarian crisis, probably the coverage has also shifted towards economic interests and geopolitical interests.
Brand says access to African countries and investment in stable media can improve coverage in Africa.
I think in general, governments need to give journalists access to the countries, and especially the crisis of the region, so reporters and journalists can report on these crises. foreign media needs to pay more attention, accept more pitches from African journalists, freelancers, from countries, foreign countries, African countries, and media needs to invest in a good, stable journalism, foreign correspondents, freelancers, and local partners.
The United Nations says more than 300 million people will need humanitarian assistance in 2024, but half of them in Africa. CARE International calls for the media to tell African humanitarian crisis stories so aid agencies and relevant authorities can take urgent action to save the situation. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally, there is a potential crisis facing the upcoming elections in the United States. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump seem on track for a rematch in November's presidential election, but questions about Trump's legal difficulties and both candidates' ages lurk in the background. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara looks at what could happen should one of them be forced to drop out.
Former President Donald Trump faces 91 felony charges, with at least one criminal trial expected this year. Health issues could impact President Joe Biden, who is 81.
Headline: Biden's advanced age is a big issue. Trump's, however, is not.
Or Trump, for that matter, who is 77.
The big night is going to be in November when we take back our country.
But what happens should one of them die or become incapacitated before the November election? If it happens before their party conventions, some states may extend primary dates to allow more candidates into the race. The winner of the primaries is officially announced as the party's presidential nominee at each party's convention. Republicans will hold theirs in July and Democrats in August. If a front runner drops out and no candidate reaches a majority, delegates can essentially nominate someone else. John C. Fortier, research fellow focusing on elections and continuity of government at the American Enterprise Institute via Skype.
There'll be a lot of freedom for those delegates to negotiate, pick someone, maybe pick someone else who wasn't running. That has happened in our history. But it will be up to the convention to decide who the nominee is for the Republican or the Democratic Party.
Should the nominee drop out after the convention, the parties would reconvene delegates to select a replacement, and it's not guaranteed that it will be the vice presidential candidate. After the election, it's a similar process. Even if, let's say, Biden wins and cannot serve, his vice president, Kamala Harris, would not automatically be the replacement and electors vote again. But what happens if electors can't agree? Michael Thorning, Director of Structural Democracy at the Bipartisan Policy Center via Skype.
At that point, the election would go to the House of Representatives if no candidate can attain a majority. And so the election really ends up in something that we have not confronted for hundreds of years.
If the president-elect dies after Congress certifies the election result on January 6, the vice president-elect would be inaugurated as president. Any of these scenarios could become an extremely messy process that drags on in the courts, especially if the result is contested. And as the country has witnessed in the siege of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters on January 6, 2021, it could again turn bloody. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
And that ends today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.